The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Just get very defensive and let this game play out. Let the opportunities come to you. And don't try to be a genius here. The smartest people in the world are still trying to figure out how to play this. And again, after 5-6 years, they've come to that realization. Just get very defensive, have a nice cash reserve, and be ready to move when you need to move, because things could happen very quickly.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and our upcoming guest here, Bill King, one of my favorite guests. I love the way Bill ties history together as if he's as fluent in it as his own family history.
40-plus years in the financial markets on a daily basis, including weekends, because I don't think he ever sleeps or takes a break. It begins to pay off in terms of the accumulation of insight and understanding in the marketplace. Every day, he puts together the King Report through M. Ramsey King Securities, and it's something that as an office we wouldn't do without. It's an invaluable tool for us as we aggregate information and try to anticipate what the markets hold for us, the gyrations, which can be very positive or very negative. Bill, great to have you back on the program. You know, since the start of July, we've had 24 separate policy measures in China in an attempt to prop up the stock market. Of course, we had overseas shipments, which fell 8.3%. That's Chinese exports were considerably lower. And in response to that, you've got the Chinese devaluing their currency. This is a pretty big deal. Maybe you can unpack this for us a bit.
Well, you're absolutely correct. It is a very big deal. And I think just your introduction has articulated how serious this is, because China has taken so many drastic steps, including the rigging of their stock market and this record devaluation. It underscores the seriousness of what is going on economically in China. And the reason they're alarmed, and this is what should scare everybody, you saw China for a number of years try to slow their economy. And now that it's tumbling, they're alarmed. And you have to say, well, why are they alarmed when in the past they were hoping to cool down some measures? And it keeps coming down to the one factor that is hanging over the whole world, debt. Too much debt. So everybody, and this has been going on since 2008, 2009, is scared to death. All your central banks, all your major sovereign nations are scared to death of the debt deflation. And they're doing whatever they can to slow it down. So where you had China a couple of years ago trying to slow down, they were afraid of overheating, they were afraid of all the debt. Several months ago, decided, my gosh, we might have a debt deflation, so they go to this hyperstimulation. They created a stock bubble. We're pretty open that we want to drive stock prices higher, so our indebted corporations can do like U.S. corporations here, issue stock and pay down their debt and get some of the investors and the banks and others more liquid. Instead, just like what's happened here in the U.S., on other hands, and in Europe, the higher prices created more leverage, created people buying and levering up, taking on more debt to do the stock. So it exacerbated the problem, and then you get a bubble, you get the margin debt going, and then it starts coming apart. And historically, when you have high debt and you have a stock bubble, it starts coming apart, you get the liquidation and you get the debt deflation. So whether it's Greece, China, U.S., Europe, and you can run through the list, this is a problem. This is a big problem in the world. It is too much debt, unserviceable, which is why we had the crisis of 08 and 09. The solution was for sovereigns and banks and others to take on even more debt, and those chickens are coming home to roost now.
So I think of the city of Chicago. Explain to me the rationale of investors who are more than happy to oversubscribe a $1 billion issue in city of Chicago debt. Obviously, Chicago is in a bit of a vortex. I mean, you probably know this better than most. You know the area, you know the geography. But, you know, indebted already? Yes. Up to their eyeballs in debt? Yes. In need of an extra $1 billion? Yes, but who are the investors who line up and are able to actually sort of disconnect credit risk with the income offer of, what was it, 5.5 or 7.5, depending on whether it was tax-free or taxable? I don't get it.
Well, there's two things there in response. The first is that that's going to be paid back. Probably not. It's unserviceable. But we're in an era of investors and traders playing old maid. When you sit down, even the U.S., is there any chance the U.S. is ever going to pay off its debt? No, especially with the demographics and the baby boomers. But you know, you got bonds here, U.S. bonds, trading at ridiculous levels. Why? Well, because people think that's the place to be and that they're going to be nimble enough to get out before the ship hits, you know, the waterfall or the end of the earth. And the same thing with the city of Chicago. You got people in here chasing yield. You got a nice yield. And there's probably some under the delusion that they can keep playing this game for eternity. And you see that. You see how that doesn't matter. You know, some renowned economists, that doesn't matter how much debt. We can just play this silly game. But others just are in this feeling that they're going to be nimble enough to jump out before an accident happens. And then there's also other things. You don't know the politics, the arm twisting. Who is being told you better buy this? The people that want to do business with the city. You know, you can have people in here buying these things because they're beholden to the city or the politics or whatever. And they could buy on the issue, but you don't know if they're selling out to some bond fund or whatever to get out. But they're making public, yeah, that we're in this, but you don't know how soon they come out. Just like an IPO. How many people are buying it just to dump it quickly? So there's several working parts here. But you've outlined this situation. Why would you do this? And there's a number of reasons why. And I think two things are political arm twisting. And the second is people that think they're going to be nimble enough to jump off before the shipwreck occurs.
We're already seeing widening credit spreads in junk starting to be treated a little bit more like junk rather than sort of some prized possession. Is there enough stress in the credit markets to say, actually, we're not changing course? This is going to be problematic. Or could we see, you know, treasury rates back around 2% on the long bond, 2.25, 2.5, and junk bonds back at 5, 5.5?
Yeah, that's a great question. The problem that we're all operating under is there is unprecedented intervention by sovereigns and central banks on a global basis. In the past, we may have had Weimar Germany or isolated cases of a country or two doing something, but on a global basis, because of this debt problem everybody has, there's unprecedented intervention. And the problem you have, and if we look historically, if there's wage and price controls and you peg commodity prices like Nixon did, and they sit there and you're pegged and you're pegged and you're pegged and nothing's happening, then all of a sudden the dam breaks loose and you have this horrible adjustment. That's the major risk for everybody out there. And that's what the Fed understands. And the Fed is talking about hiking rates, and they're not that stupid that they don't see what's going on in the world and in the U.S. economy. There's a number of economic metrics that are screaming recession here. The Fed knows that. And they know the employment games are hokey and in low-paying gigs. But they understand that they've got to start moving to normalize, or the adjustment is going to be that much more vicious. And we don't know. Nobody knows when this thing is going to show up, this adjustment. You know, we all understand that this thing can happen very quickly because it's a confidence game, literally and figuratively a confidence game here. And when it goes, it's the same thing happened in 2008. We had trouble the whole year, stocks saying everything hung in, Fed's going to do this, Fed's going to do TIF, they're going to do, you know, the TSLF. They did all these different measures and people held in, including hedge funds. Then all of a sudden, you know, Lehman goes down, boom, boom, boom. The whole economic and financial system was in collapse. And they had to do what they had to do over a number of months to save it. Enough professional investors have not learned what happened in 08 and 09, that this thing happened very, very quickly. You denied it, you denied it. You kept throwing measures up there to keep the market from collapsing. And then finally, it just got overwhelmed and it collapsed. So you're right. That's the risk. As you sit here, you look at it, and then you have people here that just say, oh, no big deal. The Fed's going to intervene. The government's going to intervene. It's not a problem. And then all of a sudden, boom, 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 boom. And it happens too quickly. And that is the risk here.
So we've got several things in play. We've got equities that are reflecting massive amounts of market intervention, also bank speculation and sort of the relevering that you were talking about earlier. We've got central bank activism, which is really the linchpin.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got a fundamental mispricing of risk. And at the same time, very few people are appreciating the amount of risk that is in the system today. I'll give you an example. City manager from a big city out in California was in town this last week, and he basically said, you know, the economy's rocking and rolling. And we looked around and what's this? The economy's rocking and rolling. What do you mean? And his response then was, well, the Dow's at 18,000, of course. And it's like, if you can push that number higher, the common belief is that the economy's just fine. And it's as if a massive PR campaign has succeeded in convincing the vast number of people that there actually is very little risk in the system, that the central bank's efforts have succeeded, and that we've already passed the all clear, which is why we're moving towards the September rate hike, and no one's questioning that the economy is in full-blown recovery. Look, unemployment's at 5.3%, and we're on schedule for September. Does this seem strange?
Well, only a handful of people believe that the stock market reflects the economy. I mean, that's going, the average guy gave that up in around 2006 and 2007, and the idiots on Wall Street were screaming at people, can't you see how great your economy is? The stock's telling us. And we had one ersatz economist telling everybody on CNBC that you don't get it. The stock market's telling you things are good. Well, no, he didn't get it, that it wasn't that good. The economy was not that good for the average guy. It was just Wall Street and the money changers and the money printers that were making the money here, and the same thing is going on now. The difference now is people on the Fed recognize this. The academics, over the last 6 months, you've seen an increasing number of academics, especially those that lean left, Keynesians, even some monetarists, saying, yeah, we've got this concentration of wealth problem. It's because we're taking money from savers and retirees and passbook accounts and CDs and giving it to Wall Street to speculate. They understand it. The Fed knows that. That's why you see even extreme doves like Williams in San Francisco, Dudley in New York, you know, the financial center people starting to back away from their dovish talk. They've been talking more hawkish. They've been trying to talk hawkish to talk the market down. And that's the mistake the Fed made, because they're academics. They're not traders. They're not bankers. You can talk a market up easily. It's hard to talk it down, and history has showed that. This is Edson Gould's old three steps and a tumble, that it took the Fed at least three rate hikes before stocks would react and roll over. And it's the same thing that's going to happen here. They're trying to talk the market down, but the market's not buying it. And it's going to take some action here from the Fed to stop this, or it's going to be like a 2008, where everybody was bullish. For crying out loud, you had an all-time high in the Dow Transportations in July 2008. The same thing, oil made an all-time high. And we were at least two quarters into recession. So what the heck was the stock market forecasting then? It totally missed it. And as you stated here, is totally missing what's going on now. And people understand that. In 08, they might have been scratching their heads, but people understand right now. And Bernanke said, and other central bankers have said, China and Japan, and the government leaders said, we're going to push stock prices up and try to create a wealth effect so we get our economy going. And it's not working. What it's done is, yeah, New York City has done well. Silicon Valley's done well because of the stock speculation, asset speculation, prime property speculation. But the rest of the country is not doing well. In fact, it's receding. And that's happening in Japan. It's happening wherever these policies have been going on, happening in China the same way. So that's their problem. They played this card. It's not working. What they also understand is we push these asset prices up, and it's not really helping the economy. But history tells us if this stuff starts crashing, we have a real problem, because then the confidence goes out the window. Then all these credit spreads and things you talked about blow up, because then, you know, as Warren Buffett said, you know, when the tide goes out, you see who's naked. Once the tide washes out here and people get concerned, there's a lot of ugliness here that's going to be exposed. And more than being exposed, it's going to force people to reckon with that ugliness that they've been ignoring. And that's the real issue here, is you take the opiate of the high stock prices away, and then you see people start scrambling.
It's interesting. You know, there's a bit of a conversation in the UK, a guy who's rising in the ranks in the Labour Party by the last name of Corbyn, and he's suggesting that we need less QE for the banks, more QE for the people. And rather than say, you know, there's a problem with QE and a failure in the monetary transmission mechanism, he's saying, actually, we just need to get rid of the middleman. And I think to myself, is that the way you cope with a mistake?
No, the problem is the QE for the public has been done for decades, which is your entitlement program. And all the QE that we've been doing the last, since 2009, is entitlements for the 0.1%. It's not the 1%, it's like the 0.1%. That's their QE. But where are the people getting the most pressure? The middle class, the merchant class, because they're not getting the QE. The entitlement spending and everything has gone high. That's the reason why the UK is having a conservative revolution. That's the reason why Donald Trump is soaring here, because the middle class is getting killed. Because you're getting QE for the top end, and you're getting the QE in the form of entitlements for the bottom end. And in between, the people getting squeezed are the middle class and the merchant class. And that's the problem. That's why the Tea Party rose up after the 2009 debacle. Nothing has changed for the lower class. They're still getting their entitlements. In fact, it's increased. And the upper class is getting the QE benefit of the equities. And of course, the QE also benefits the lower, the entitlement class, because, you know, it doesn't put pressure on the government to reform the entitlement. As you said, it's in Chicago. Say state of Illinois, say Cook County, you could say the rest of the country. Nobody's doing any entitlement reform. You know, they're screaming about Greece, and the same thing is going on here. But the people who are getting killed are the middle class and the merchant class, the independent business people. They're the ones that are taking the hits here, so you can support the flat ends of the bell curve here in society. But that's why you see Bernie Sanders getting these big crowds and enthusiasm. Same thing with Donald Trump, because there's anti-establishment sentiment is just soaring here. And that happened in the UK with their election last May, where unexpectedly the conservatives came in. That's why you're seeing this revolt against immigration, because the people that are getting clubbed by immigration and have tough economic times understand how immigration is hurting them. And you saw that in France with Le Pen, a conservative, what, a year ago or so, with her election. So this is not just the U.S. This is a global trend here. And there's going to be ramifications between now and 2016 here.
So let's circle back around to the Chinese, because it's something that has implications outside of China, clearly. Regionally, even overnight, so you see a 2% devaluation in the Chinese currency and a number of commodity currencies, including the Aussie dollar, down 1% at least. And it's kind of a knock-on effect. Is this the equivalent of a currency war? You could argue we've already been in it for enough time, but are we moving into the next phase?
Yeah, it's not the equivalent of a currency war. It is a currency war. And this is the next escalation. Those of us old enough remember Vietnam, they talked about, an escalation in the war. You know, you bombed harder, you did something, you sent more troops. You got it right. It is an escalation in the currency war that has been going on for years. The beggar thy neighbor, export your way. And that's what Japan did. This was the point of Abenomics. And he said that. We're going to crush the yen, and this will do two things. It'll boost our exports, and it'll boost the stock market, and we're going to get the economy going. And it didn't. It did not, and it's killing the Japanese middle class same way, the savers, the retirees, and they can't get their economy going. The people haven't figured out that QE is deflationary because it reduces your interest income. It helps a few. It helps the people that own stocks. But by and large, it crushes your predictable income stream. If anybody took portfolio management 101, they understand that all your decisions, your spending, whether it's a consumer or a business as far as capital spending, or your pensions are all based on your fixed income portfolio, your predictable income stream, your passbook savings, your CDs, your money markets, your bond holdings. Then you go out to stocks and rubber. And that's what these idiot academics at the Fed didn't understand. Part of it's because of their lack of real-world experience in banking in the industry. Part of it is because they ignored even the academic research because it didn't fit their theory. But that is how it works. Predictable income stream first. And if you sat down with anybody, with your wealth managers, you know, which are basically stockbrokers now, that they tell you, first thing you have to have is a predictable income and earnings stream. Then you build your stock portfolio, and then there you can move out to your gold, your silver, your farmland, your commodities, whatever you want. But the first foremost, you have to set up your fixed income stream. And that's what these guys have destroyed on a global basis, and that's why it's deflationary to the average person, not just in actuality, but mentally. When you, as a retiree, are used to getting 5-6%, and all of a sudden you crush it down to 0.5%, you cut your predictable income stream by 90%, what do you think you're going to do? You're going to go back to work at Walmart if you're retired? You take on a second job? Your spending goes to hell. That's the problem. And these idiots in the central banks haven't done it. Well, I think some of them figured it out, but they see no recourse. In fact, that's what Draghi said a couple months ago to the retirees. He goes, yeah, I know we're killing you, but you're going to thank me later because higher asset prices are going to be good for you eventually. What kind of BS is that? He's telling you, you know, you get eviscerated, but eventually the 0.1% will be doing so well, they'll get the economy going. That's garbage. And that's why you're getting this political revolt in here worldwide.
Yeah, it seems like you're setting up something that's ripe for sort of social disjunction. I mean, we had 1968 historically, which is sort of, you know, the summer of chaos and a trend setting for a lot of change thereafter. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about the summer of 2015, the summer of 2016, where it's a little bit different than the Arab Spring, but it is an expression of social frustration, the middle class being eviscerated, it not being a U.S. issue, but a global issue. something I've raised as an issue in the office is that the stakes may not be financial in nature, but in past periods of de-globalization, it was tanks and bombs and guns. Financial issues led to much bigger issues, and we sacrificed entire generations of young men to solve problems that came out of those financial crises.
Well, that's a possibility. And but people would counter you and say, well, we've been in a state of war since 2001 with the September 11th attack, and there's a lot of merit to that. The problem is World War II took about 3 years or so to win. We've been now going to be going on 15 years here, 14 now going on 15. What have we done? What have you done? It's the old story is you've taken half measures. At least in World War II, the objective was clear. You're going to defeat Japan, you're going to defeat Germany, the Nazis. Now, there's no stomach for it. There's no objective for it. It's all Chamberlainisms. Well, we're going to negotiate this. We're going to ignore that. We don't want to get our hands dirty. We don't want to be involved, blah, blah, blah. You had that conflict. You got it over with relatively quickly. I mean, when you think about it, D-Day was, what, June 44. By May 45, you were done with your war in Europe. And then in August, you're finished with Japan. So as far as the actual conflict, there was planning and there was things going on. And there was excursions in 43 in Africa and some of the other areas, Italy, whatever, after that. But you know, the big assault was relatively quickly. What are we doing now? How long are we going to keep this pity-pat around? This is worse than Vietnam, what we're doing now. But you're doing the same thing. Half measures. What's politically acceptable measures? What's the least we can do measures? Instead of going in like Eisenhower did in Europe, or actually like Pitt was doing, would be probably a better thing. Instead of doing a patent on this stuff and getting it over with, we're not.
So we've got fundamental mispricing of risk in the market. We've got central bank activism on a scale, as you said, it's unprecedented, the amount of intervention that we have. We just play this game for another 20 years and watch the central banks manage their rabbit-beating program?
No, you can't, because we see the market forces and what's going on is starting to revolt against that. But the other thing is you have lack of political will.
We have clients all the time who say, yeah, listen, they've taken this a lot further than we thought they could. Who's to say they can't take this another 20 years? And I don't know that I have the perfect answer.
Well, you can't, because the numbers tell you, the mathematics tells you it's collapsing on top of you. Greece tells you that. China is telling you that. If nobody was doing anything and we're just sitting around, that's one thing. The global conflicts are telling you. It's the lack of political leadership in the United States, the will to address serious problems, as well as Europe, your leading nations, your world leaders. They don't have the political will to do what is necessary. That's the problem. They don't have the will to go in there and do this stuff, whether it's in the Middle East, whether it's with the economy. And besides the lack of political, there's the corruption. There's the rapid corruption of the political process worldwide that is people just holding, let's hold on, let's just hope this doesn't get any worse. And it, you know, this is basically what Europe did when Hitler was on the move. Well, it hasn't hit us yet. You know, he's just fooling around with Czechoslovakia, the Sudetenland, or he just did this Anschluss with Austria. It hasn't hit us yet. You know, everything's been really okay, so let's just hope this we can hang on for another 20 years and, you know, then Hitler will die or something. Come on, we're past that stage here.
So classically, if you've got too much debt, you can default on it. That's one solution. You can just have sort of the soft default via a slower process, what we know as inflation.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of work around it a little bit through financial repression, but it's not the best solution. How do you think we solve a world that's too much in debt? Corporate debt, government debt, private debt, swimming in it.
And you default it or you hyperinflate it? In the 70s, even in the 60s, they tried the slow partial default via inflation. And everybody would have a brain understood it. But you saw when the revolt happened, Volcker had to come in and administer the medicine because it just got too severe. The problem is that everybody is trying to inflate. You know, the average person sits there and listens to these idiots from the Fed and these idiot economists on Wall Street go, oh, we have a problem. There's not enough inflation. And people are sitting there where their incomes are stagnant or receding. And they're going, are you kidding me? That we need more inflation? No, they're talking from a government. They're talking from an indebted standpoint. The indebted need inflation. The human history, progress is marked by lower prices. That's why you built canals in the 1800s here. That's why you built railroads and you had reapers and harvests to lower prices. That's why you have the Intels and these to make, you know, less costly and more powerful computer chips to lower the cost. That's what human progress standard of living has come from, not higher prices, from lower prices, the Model T, the assembly line. Yet these idiot economists go, oh, you know, the problem is we don't have enough inflation. And the average guy's going, are you kidding me? Not only the government accounting for inflation is ridiculous, and everybody understands it doesn't really tell you what inflation is, but the average guy's going, are you kidding me? I need more inflation? No, that's people that are big government, people that are indebted are the ones screaming, we need the inflation. My man, that's so ridiculous. And again, that's where people lose it. They're going, what are you talking about? That inflation is good? And historically, it's not been good. It's been horrible. Also, inflation is marked lower living standards and lower progress. But it is a way to get rid of debt. That's the only reason people are saying we need the inflation here. Again, these idiot academics and central bankers are talking from what favors them, not from what favors the average person.
What happens if you default?
Well, then you start over. You know, the first thing is you have the chain reaction of wiping out wealth and capital. And then you see where it settles. That's what they're all afraid of. They don't know where it's going to stop. They don't think they can stop it once it starts because it is so vast. And you don't know. You don't know. You just don't know how far it goes. But we know the longer they wait, the worse it will be, the worse the adjustment is. And they've been doing this for at least 20 years now, trying to keep the day of reckoning at bay. You know, the U.S. has been doing this for a while, as has Europe. Europe's been in decline since World War I, actually. And you go through this whole process. But it really took in the 90s when you had, first you had the Mexican default, the Mexican problem in 94. And you could just see, we had the 91, 92 were Citibank, and the Bank of Boston, Bank of New England, the different money center banks that all disappeared. Bankers Trust, Chemical Bank, you had Chase going with JP. I mean, just all these manufacturers, Hanover, these were money center banks, all just disappeared. And that was the first where when Greenspan just started really printing the money, the carry trade, and then Japan. You went through these series of crises in the 90s. 97, Asian contagion. 98, you had long-term capital management, you had the Russian default, you had Monica Lewinsky. So what did you do? You created a bubble here, stock bubble, so everybody would not see this and forget about it. Of course, then it all blew up. Then you had 9/11. Was it Brazil in 2003 defaulted or actually whatever? That's when, you know, they bring Bernanke in late 2002 because Greenspan's worried of the debt deflation. And Ben's given a helicopter speech that we're going to print all the money we can to keep the deflation at bay. Then you create the housing bubble. That pops. You know, that rolls over in 2006. And just see these series of crises. And even though the U.S. after 2009 started moving up, Europe has been a series of crises from, what, 2011, when you went through that hole with the pigs, saving all those countries, saving the banks, and it's every, what, 9 months a year, another European crisis shows up. But very little has been solved. The only one who really solved their problem was Iceland, because they did default. They did stop all the nonsense. They didn't take all this loans and all this other stuff from the ECB and the IMF and whatever, and they kind of got out of it. But they were smart. They got out of it. You know, it's just like a bad trade. You get out of it, that first loss is your best loss before it keeps piling on. But that's where we're at here. And the world has been in search of a safe haven for, what, 6 years now? And, you know, everything's overpriced because interest rates are so low. It's not that you just have a bond bubble. Greenspan alluded to this just the other day, that you had this bond bubble sitting here. It's beyond a bubble. It's a corner. There's a difference between a bubble and a corner. And the central banks and the sovereigns have cornered the bond markets of the world because it helps them service their debt. That's what should be in everybody's mind. Yeah, stock market, it's important. You know, China, this whole thing. The real issue is when the bond corner breaks, when people just say, nope, that's it. And it will show up first in the currency because that's what you would do. You would get currency exposure first. And that's the issue here that could be a real problem for China. Once you start down this road of pushing currencies downhill, and the market believes it's a one-way trade, or they get concerned, the only way you're going to stop that is really draconian interest rate hikes. That's the only way. Or you have to change your national policies, which is very hard to do. That's why currencies trend better than any vehicle, because it's very hard, very tedious to change your national policy.
Even in the way I sort of set up the question originally, you know, yeah, it's a one-way trade in the sense that 1.9% devaluation doesn't get you anywhere. That's not enough to give you trade advantage. It's maybe the first olive out of the jar, but it certainly is not sufficient if you're trying to achieve a trade advantage. I mean, maybe there's other things in play, but my presumption is that it's the first of many. It'd be difficult, I would think, for many to see it otherwise. Back to the U.S. markets, we're dealing with the Fed, who is not willing to deal with their fear of the unknown. That's really what deflation represents, is fear of the unknown. And on the other side of the equation, they're willing to throttle things with a certain presumption of control. How do you disconnect a poor record with presumption of control and positive outcomes? Because if the Fed's reflective at all, if any central bank's reflective, this is more art than science. You don't always get it right. In fact, a lot of times you get it dead wrong. And yet there is this, we're just going to throttle this a little bit more inflation here, and then everything's going to be fine. We'll begin to raise rates. We got it under control.
Part of it's arrogance, you know, only the arrogance that academics can have because they don't have real world experience. And their experience is browbeating teenagers or young adults into their beliefs to get the grade they need to pass a course or to get into graduate school. You know, we've all had that experience here. It's a different matter to browbeat somebody when you hold a big axe over their head and they can tell you junk and push junk on you and have you believe junk and write up in junk so you can get an A or B in the course, whatever, but in the real world, it doesn't work. That is the biggest transformation that I've seen in the Fed, is when you went to Volcker, he was the last guy that had real banking experience coming out of Chase Bank. He was a banker. Greenspan had zero. Greenspan was, I hate to call him an academic, because his whole academic record is an issue as to what he really did to get his PhD and whatever. He was a horrible forecaster on Wall Street, Townsend Greenspan. It was actually kind of a joke on the street. People couldn't understand why they put him in at the Fed, except that George Bush wanted to be president. And Jim Baker and these guys wanted Greenspan in 87, came in August of 87, because they didn't want Volcker to do a Volcker right ahead of George H.W. Bush's election in 88. And that's why Greenspan was brought in, because he was compliant, as we found out he's done throughout his history, whether he was sitting up there with Hillary Clinton next to her at the State of the Union, and Bill's first State of the Union, you know, whatever, pumping the money when the Lewinsky scandal broke in January of 88 to keep Clinton from being convicted in the Senate. Whatever, that's what Greenspan did, and that's why he was brought in, not because of his record. He wasn't a banker. He wasn't a good forecaster, and Bernanke was brought in because he appropriated Milton Friedman's life work. Then that's why he was called a deflation and depression specialist, because he would just say, oh, we'll just print everything we need to print it. Really? I mean, that's a sign of being smart and being a genius, is that, oh, yeah, if we're going to have deflation, we just print everything we can to stop it, and that's what they brought him in.
Well, it sounds like that's what's being paraded now. Yeah. So you mentioned a minute ago that for 6 years, the world's been looking for a safe haven. In a world of competitive devaluations, with this instinct for a safe haven, but with asset prices pretty high, pretty much everywhere you look and go, what is a safe haven? What is a safe haven in general? Where do you go? Bringing this down to sort of brass tacks.
There's nowhere now, because as you were alluding to before, this game has been playing out for many years. There's so much money. Everything is overpriced. Everything is overpriced. And that's what you just don't know. What you don't know is where the next liquidity preference comes from. That's what decades ago vexed the Fed. In the 70s, the money ran into real assets. In the 80s, when Volcker cut loose in July of 82, the money ran into financial assets. And that's kind of a normal cycle. They were grossly underpriced. And that's why you saw these LBO guys, you know, the KKRs, and these people just pop up and do very well. And then the same thing in the 90s. Then when you got the great U.S. stock bubble, the most underpriced vehicle were commodities. That's why you saw some people say the super cycle began. Gold, oil, and just go through the list, copper. All this stuff was really bottoming around in the late 90s and then just took off. That's where you needed to be up until, you could say 2011 when gold, silver peaked, but oil peaked in 08. You know, there were signs there that things were happening, but that's where you should have been. Now, they've pushed everybody. Again, they cornered the bonds. They've pushed stocks higher. You've got central banks buying stocks, whether it's Swiss National Bank, go through the whole list, China, Japan, they're buying stocks, which is mind-boggling. 10 years ago, nobody would have thought that this would have happened. So once you start overpricing bonds, then it goes into stocks, it goes into farmland, it goes into prime real estate, et cetera, et cetera. What people that have means and brains are doing now is trying to figure out what is going to decline the least. Where's your store of wealth? At this point, you don't know, so the best avenue is to have a broad portfolio with liquidity. That's all you can do at this point. Have a little real estate, some precious metals, and liquidity. Maybe if you have farmland, maybe, you know, different types of real estate. You got to be very careful with the type of real estate you want to own. But you get some industries that have great balance sheets with little debt, but you want a nice cash hoard so that you can move. If we start inflating, the market picks up the inflation. The liquidity preference of the critical mass of investors is to go for real assets. You can run to that very quickly. If you're going to have deflation, you have an ample cash reserve that you can wait and pick up bargains very carefully over a long-term basis. You know, this isn't something where you run in one day and CNBC goes, oh, this is the bottom in oil, buy it, which they did in, what, June? This is the bottom in oil? 70-some percent of the people said, yeah, okay. And it kept going down. That's what's going to happen. People did not lose a ton of money in a 29 break. Not one firm on Wall Street went bust. Where they all went bust was in 31, 32, when it just kept going. And that's when Jesse Livermore went broke. And he made a fortune, but he bought all the way down. That's where people lose the money, is when you get into a protracted bear market, let alone a deflation. You keep buying all the way down. People just can't believe how low these things can go. And that will be the risk on the way down here. The people that were bears for years, if not decades, quickly start buying on the way down. And that will be the issue. Again, it always is.
You know, one of the things we never saw in 2009 was a real capitulation psychologically in the stock market. We got to values, if you're looking at the Q ratio and cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio, it got to discounted levels, but nothing like what we saw in previous recessions or depressions. Nowhere close. What you're talking about is a broken sentiment. Somebody who doesn't want to look at stocks probably the rest of their life, or whatever the asset class is in question. Aren't we moving closer to that? I mean, when you say that people of means are just looking for assets to be able to lose less than they would otherwise, but the assumption is you're going to, you have to. At this point, everything's right. Overpriced. There's really no getting out of it. I'm looking for the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow.
Well, everybody has. They've been looking for 5 years, 6 years, and it's been this rotation. Well, it was, you know, first you had oil and gold and silver went up in 2011 when they started doing the QEs. Then that thing broke. You know, you've had the real estate, people have run the real estate, especially prime properties in certain areas. But if you look around the country, that game has ended in the last few months. You know, you're doing the biotechs on a global basis. You can see this. Everybody's running, trying to say, you know, where do we hide out? The average guy, though, is not doing that because he doesn't have the means to do it and the time and the mental energy to do all that stuff. But the very wealthy people, they've been running on this treadmill, and now they're just slowing down, and they're just sitting there, they're getting liquid. They have what they consider a balanced, diversified portfolio with a lot of cash, and they're just waiting now to see where they should go. And they're not getting ahead of themselves, they're not getting ahead of the market, they're not getting too far over their skis, whatever cliche you want to use here. Letting the game come to them, et cetera, et cetera. And I guess that would be the best thing. Don't get out there, just get very defensive, and let this game play out. Let the opportunities come to you. And right now, that's the best advice I think anybody can give and the best advice somebody should adhere to here. Don't try to be a genius here. This is really, really tricky. The smartest people in the world are still trying to figure out how to play this. And again, after 5-6 years, they've come to that realization is just get very defensive, have a nice cash reserve, and be ready to move when you need to move, because things could happen very quickly.
The tone of our conversation today captures what is deep in my gut. There's very little that you can do that's, well, here's the answer, here's the solution, one that you feel really good about.
Yeah.
It seems to me, Bill, that part of the safe haven solution is cash. Part of the safe haven solution is precious metals.
Mm-hmm.
And help me wrap my mind around this, because there's the two-tiered market between the physical market and the paper market. And most recently, the paper gold market's upwards of 124 times the scale of the physical market in terms of what's deliverable.
Mm-hmm.
Talking to some of the exchanges, we've got a delay of 2 weeks on kilo bar delivery.
Mm-hmm.
We've got anywhere from 12 to 20% premiums on your smaller silver items. 1,000-ounce silver bars are still plentiful with no premiums, but you're beginning to see stress and strain in terms of supply demand.
Mm-hmm.
And yet in the paper world, it's still just getting beat to snot. Absolutely beat to snot.
See, this thing we don't know. How long? Again, every billionaire I know has a big stash of cash and they've got a good chunk of gold. 10% or thereabout of their net worth, some as much as 15 to 20. Not just gold, but in real assets. But there's no question. There's a reason why the gold went and ran to the moon in 2011. Yeah, there were some little guys, but by and large, this was the billionaires of the world getting their insurance policies. And once it got too high, they backed away. And then it's come down. And now they're playing a very slow, methodical. These are real buyers. This isn't HFT guys. And if you're a real buyer, you want to buy as low as possible. And that's what they're doing. That's why they have the cash. They're going to sit here, and they've got their insurance policy. They'll slowly add, very cautiously, very methodically add. And by that, I mean, if you're an industrialist or you're a wealthy person, you set your portfolio up, and then you have an income stream. And at the end of the year, you look and see, you know, your income stream has added this much to your cash position. Then you rebalance your portfolio again. You buy a little more gold. You buy whatever it is you're hedging, a little real estate, what other businesses. You do your rebalancing. And if you're going to do that, you don't run out there and buy gold and chase it. You just very carefully give your guy an order, and he buys you some coins, some bars, or whatever. And you're happy to just slowly build this position. Now, if you're going to pay insurance, do you want to pay high premium or low premium? And that's how these guys are looking at it. I want to keep buying at a low price. My insurance, that's what all the gold represents to these guys. This is insurance of their net worth and political turmoil. And they want to buy it as cheap as possible. With the idiot hedge funds and these other HFT guys and that, they race in, they race out, et cetera, et cetera. But it seems to me that there will be an incredible, mind-boggling gold rally at some point. But the issue, and again, most of the smart, wealthy people understand this, you might see gold get hammered in the initial stages of a debt deflation. That was the lesson of 08, that gold went down to, what, below 700 or whatever, got into that area, and then it took off to 1900. That's what they're playing for again. That's probably how this thing is going to play again, that there'll be a hammering of gold. You know, this is what we've been experiencing in here. But the reason it hasn't totally collapsed is there is the slow, methodical buying here. I mean, when you look at the chart of gold and what's going on with the dollar and whatever, you would think that they would just absolutely crater gold. And they have. They go out there and they do these raids. It's very interesting. The raid lasts a few minutes and then it kind of stabilizes and moves up. And I've seen it in stocks. You know, my 40-some years in the stock market, when you see stocks get busted, and it's a stock that has good fundamental value, and something happened, like some accident or just, or a stock just gets hammered for some reason, you see the real buyers will show up. Not immediately. You'd get it hammered, they would let it fall, and then all of a sudden the real buyers show up, and then the traders figure out real quickly that there's bids here, and these are real people, and then they go the other way, which is what you see in gold. You know, they'll go in on this raid and whack it down, and then all of a sudden you'll see it stabilize, and then all of a sudden you see the traders cover short go the other way. And that's what the smart traders see. Is that reloaders show up. And part of that is that the brokers see who the others are coming from. They see it's, you know, somebody of means or whatever, and they're in there and they're like, we better cover our shorts too. And it gets around, they call their traders and go, hey, we got real buyers here, gold. Okay, let's cover. And that's why the gold hasn't just absolutely gotten floored yet.
Yet is an ominous word.
Yeah.
It's great to be able to buy it cheaper.
And that's the other thing is when you have real buyers, and I've seen it in the same thing in stocks, where you got real buyers and they're buying at a certain level, certain values. And then you get like October of 79 or even the mini version of 78, let alone in 87. You get these events, you just pull your orders. And the reason you do that is you want to see where it settles. And then you pull your orders. And that's what will happen in a debt deflation. People are going to pull their orders and wait to see what happens. You know, I understand. I think I understand perfectly what was going on in gold here and who's been buying, who has bought it, why it ran where it did, why it backed off. Because the people of means got their gold positions from 09 through 2011. They bought their insurance. They weren't going to chase it anymore. You know, they're not going to pay that. You saw that in 09, 10, and in 11 at the storage in Europe, Singapore, they were running out of storage. The Swiss banks went from an omnibus holding cell or whatever they called it, a vault, so you could have personal. If you had 10 million or more gold, you had your own vault. I remember that, UBS. If you had more than 10 million, we'd give you your own vault. You wouldn't be in our omnibus vault with all the other guys. Now, this went on huge. This was enormous. Again, I know plenty of guys that did this and bought it and stored it and put safes in. I mean, even mutual fund guys, the high up CIOs, whatever, they were buying gold and putting vaults in their houses and storing it after 2008 and 2009. And they got your positions, and then they said, okay, now we're going to sit and wait. That's where we're at. That's where we're at. That's exactly what the gold price told people, that that's what happened.
Yeah, oil's the same deal. You've got a paper trade, which is more significant in terms of volumes in the physical market. Who calls the shots and for how long? You know, when we got up to 140, we're not talking about real supply and demand. We can't be. I mean, there's trading fluff in there.
Yeah, but the difference with oil is, with the exception of money, it's the most utilized commodity. Gold's not. You don't settle trade with gold. Banks do not settle their accounts with gold anymore. So, you know, they can do this for a long time. The problem, the traders can take control of a market, whether it's the grains or any of these commodities. But if they're industrial commodities, they can only last so long before they have a problem. and that's with oil. You have a problem. You know, people can store it. Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, they can buy tankers, they can store it, they can do all this stuff. But at some point, they have to let go because the market will force them. The commercial market will force them. The big commercials, the Standard Oils, the Exxons, you know, the Totals, the Russians, whatever, will say, oh, you guys, you know, either way, are you guys pushing it this low? Well, fine, we'll buy it. And then they have a problem. Or if you push it too high, they're like, okay, here, we'll load you up with it. That's not the case with gold because you don't have, the commercials aren't a factor right now. But by that same token, when it comes time for a big run in gold, you can't count on the commercials there to feed the market, to temper the rally also. That's the other side of that gold issue and why it can get really crazy on the way. Again, on the way up in commodities, you can have commercials feeding the market, you know, for a number of reasons, one of which is government regulation and mining and whatever, and how long it takes to get a gold mine to produce and into production, and all, et cetera, et cetera. You get a runaway gold market, and there's not a lot the commercials are going to be. Yeah, they'll feed it. There'll be some guys hedging, but it's not going to make that much difference as it would in oil or the grains or copper. Gold's actually outperforming your industrial metals here, and I tried to allude to this in the letter, and there's a reason for that. Again, because the commercials have to feed. They have to do something. It costs them with the inventory, where gold is starting to take on a safe haven effect a little bit in here. I mean, really, the best play here is cash or some form of cash, you know, being bonds or, I hate to say U.S. Treasuries, whatever, and gold. That's kind of the trade here that you should have on here and wait to see what happens. The problem with buying the miners is you don't know how this is going to shake out. Who's going to go under?
There'll be plenty that go under.
Yeah, there are. Well, ultimately, that's more bullish for gold, but in the interim here, you just got to be very careful. I still think when the market turns, obviously, you want to be in. Probably the big producers first and the junior second would be the rotation. But right now, the physical gold makes far more sense to me than it does to the miners at this point. And of course, that's what the market's telling you. And again, that's because the big private wealth is not buying miners. They're buying the physical. They're buying it carefully. And it's when people start going, oh, look at this ratio. It's never been. Well, you know why? There's a reason why you have that ratio. But anyway, it's going to be real interesting and very tough over the foreseeable future here. You can see the rhythm of the markets and the problems and the things showing up and the people. The pace is increasing. Now, this isn't 2010, 11, 12, where people just kind of snoozed and were hoping, whatever. There's stuff happening now.
Well, we wish you well. Chicago's got its issues, but of course you get out of there enough for it to not be always a bother. Appreciate your thoughts. Appreciate your insights. Yeah, you know, on a weekly basis, on a daily basis, we benefit from seeing your reports and compiling data the way that you do. You're very good at that.
Thank you very much.
It's something that as an office, I would say depend on. So I do appreciate the work that you put into that each week and each day.
Well, thank you for the kind words. I appreciate it.
Look forward to seeing you again when we're up in your neighborhood. And thanks for joining us.
Oh, anytime. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Bill King. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.